Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 837, titled Cauldron, Update on Ukraine. This is being recorded on March 1st of the year 2015. The title of the program refers both to a nickname that had been applied to the eastern Ukrainian city of Debaltseve. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. D-E-B-A-L-T-S-E-V-E. It was nicknamed the Cauldron by some of the combatants there. It was the scene of some fierce fighting between the eastern Ukrainian separatist forces and Ukrainian government forces. And the title not only refers to the specific city of Debaltseve, but rather like the cauldron of the witches in Macbeth could be brewing up something much, much more unsavory and ultimately more destructive even than that particular battle has been. As I am speaking, on March 1st of the year 2015, a shaky ceasefire is in effect, and the Ukrainian government and its Amen chorus in the West are claiming all sorts of violations, and in particular, violations of the truce by the rebels and by Russia. I would note that Debaltseve was one of the major focal points of the negotiations, and the Russian representatives, President Putin, were very emphatic about indicating that Debaltseve should be basically removed from the overall considerations for a variety of both strategic and tactical reasons. What we're going to be looking at in this program is, in effect, the lack of credibility and also the venality of the OUNB fascist forces who are in control in Ukraine, and the lack of reliability of, well, really, the resonant journalistic and propagandistic lobby in the West. We're going to be taking a look at the drift to nuclear war, one of the very few people in the West who has been doing some intelligent coverage of what's going on in Ukraine is Robert Perry from Consortium News, although the coverage he has presented is limited. It is at least sane and covering some of the main variables, and one of the things that Perry has noted is that the events unfolding in Ukraine could very easily lead to nuclear war. In that regard, we're going to be taking a look at some of the misleading and in some cases deliberately fabricated propaganda. We're going to be taking a look, as we are roughly a year from the Maidan coup that ushered in elements like Svoboda, Pravi Sektor, people like Roman Zvarich, Yaroslav Stetsko's personal secretary, and other similar elements evolved from the OUNB fascist collaborators of Stefan Bandera, collaborators of the Third Reich, that is. We're going to be taking a look at indications that the Maidan sniper attacks may very well have not been simply unprovoked shooting by the security forces, but that, in fact, there are indications that snipers had been attacking the security forces before. We're going to take a look at the fact that the areas from which the protester sniper fire apparently took place were under the control of the, quote, commandant of the Maidan, a guy named Andrei Parubiy. He was not only the interim defense minister of Ukraine, he is from the Svoboda Party. And another element that we're going to review about the Maidan snipers concerns a fellow who was fingered as being, and there's a pun there, was fingered as being one of the government snipers, one of the government shooters in the Maidan massacre. And it turned out that this fellow who was charged by the Ukrainian government, had only one hand, and yet pictures of him supposedly show him holding a rifle with two hands, whereas he only had one hand. Not surprisingly, that fellow has since sought political asylum in Russia. I would note that the fellow who was presiding over those proceedings was a guy named Oleg Magnitsky, also from Svoboda. And Oleg Magnitsky is now an advisor to Petro Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine. The New York Times, whose really sorry coverage of Ukraine in many ways exemplifies the Orwellian nature of the journalistic coverage of Ukraine in the West, has given reportage in which they uncritically present the views of Azov battalion commanders and founders as though these were simply credible and unconcerned journalistic sources. We're going to take a look at the deliberate channeling of disinformation to, among others, Senator James Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, who was given some misleading photographs of what was supposed to be Russian armor, etc., invading Ukraine. We're also going to take a look at a tweet. And boy, I tell you, I don't think I am ever going to get used to using 140 characters as journalistic fare. But these are those kinds of times. And the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, a guy named Jeffrey Pyatt, P-Y-A-T-T, sent out a tweet in which he said, yep, the photographs that I've seen certainly appear to show Russian armor. These are not Ukrainian units at all. Well, the photographs that he cited, once again, are from a private company called Digital Globe. These are not U.S. reconnaissance photographs or reconnaissance photographs coming from any other credible government source. Digital Globe is a private company founded by people who are veterans of Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, a.k.a. Star Wars, and the executives have backgrounds with companies like Bain Capital or Bain & Company, Mitt Romney's old firm, and the IHS Thyssen-Bornemisza subsidiary that is at the center of the peak oil propaganda as well. We're going to be taking a look at apparent right sector or private sector cells in the U.S., and it is those kinds of elements that have been producing the support for the disingenuous propaganda that has been put forth in support of the Ukrainian government. We're going to be reviewing some aspects of the Balkans war as well, in which similar ginned-up propaganda and phony atrocity stories were used to justify the NATO bombing campaign in Kosovo. And in Kosovo and elsewhere in the former Yugoslavia, rather like what we're seeing in Ukraine, the combatants who are on the West side are either the direct heirs to, or in some cases, the actual personalities who were involved in as Nazi allies in World War II. For example, a guy named Shreko Rover, a veteran of the Croatian Ustashi regime, was back in Croatia in support of the Neo-Ustashi in that country. Alija Izetbegović, the first president of Bosnia, had, as a young man, belonged to the Young Muslims that had been recruiting for the 13th Waffen-SS or Hanjar Division, a Waffen-SS division composed primarily of Bosnian Muslims. We're going to be taking a look, too, at some of the thoughts of Robert Perry about the drift toward nuclear war. And once again, we're going to revisit the subject of the Ukrainian diaspora and the newest appointees to the new Ukrainian government, although perhaps the term Ukrainian belongs in quotes. We're going to be looking at a woman named Janika Murillo. She's actually from Estonia, but she is of Ukrainian extraction, and she is going to be, quote, attracting foreign investment unquote, as a right-hand person to Ukrainian-American finance minister Natalie Jaresko, a former State Department officer who had managed capital that was generated through the Agency for International Development. Gianluca Murillo is an individual who, well, let's just say she's given to making some or posting some very suggestive/provocative pictures on the internet, which if she were Miley Cyrus, for example, that would be expected. But for a woman who is both a member of the Estonian parliament and a businesswoman and now an advisor to the Ukrainian government, these types of pictures are, to say the least, inappropriate. Another advisor to Poroshenko is none other than former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili. He is going to be in charge of procuring arms for the new Ukrainian government. That also is somewhat discouraging, aside from the fact that we are, as Robert Perry has noted and as we will cover, drifting toward nuclear war. Certainly that is a possibility. Having a guy like Saakashvili, who is an unabashed anti-Russian and who also has been charged by legal officials in his own country with a number of serious crimes, including covering up murder, this is a guy who cannot return to the country that he had led. If he were to return to Georgia, he is very likely to be sent to prison. With people like Gianluca Murillo, again, who manifests a public persona that would be more appropriate for Miley Cyrus, and people like Mikhail Saakashvili. Both of them, they're not even Ukrainians, and in Saakashvili's case, a guy who has basically been charged with multiple felonies, and if he were ever to return to his native country, would likely go to prison. These are things that, for lack of a better term, could be said to characterize the Caligulization of the political process. This is some of what we have in on tap for the program. So let's jump right in with a new perspective on the Maidan massacre. Recall that the demonstrations in Kiev just about a year ago precipitated the overthrow of Yanukovych when a bunch of protesters were fired on by Ukrainian security forces in the Maidan Square, and that the resulting outrage drove Yanukovych from office. At the time, we were told that the Ukrainian security forces were firing on unarmed protesters. Gradually, however, that story began to disintegrate, and it appears that there were certainly snipers among the demonstrators, and that they may very well have started the shooting on the security forces, which resulted in the massacre. We're going to review one story and examine another. One of the keys to understanding this dynamic is to understand the Svoboda Party. That is an explicitly fascist party that are direct heirs to the OUNB Bandera Party that collaborated with the Third Reich in World War II. And two of the key people involved here, one is Andrei Paruby, that's in Paruby. He was in charge of the Maidan. His title was Commandant of the Maidan, and he was in charge of the areas from which witnesses saw sniper fire directed at the security forces. Andrei Paruby, again, a member of the Svoboda Party, he then became the interim defense minister of the transition government in Ukraine. And we're also going to review the story about the one-handed security guy who supposedly used two hands that he didn't have to shoot at the protesters in Maidan. Again, the guy overseeing that investigation is a guy named Oleg Makhnitsky, Makhnitsky. He also is from the fascist Svoboda Party, and he was the interim justice minister, or the chief prosecutor for the transition government. We're going to begin with this story from the BBC News of February 11th of 2015. It's by Gabriel G. Gatehouse, G-A-T-E-H-O-U-S-E, the untold story of the Maidan massacre. And after discussing the basics and how the gunfire in Maidan Square led to the overthrow of Yanukovych, we read, skipping down, the protest leaders, some of whom now hold positions of power in the new Ukraine, insist full responsibility for the shootings lies with the security forces acting on behalf of the previous government. But 1 year on, some witnesses are beginning to paint a different picture. "I was shooting downwards at their feet," unquote, says a man we will call Sergei, who tells me he took up position in the Kiev Conservatory, a music academy on the southwest corner of the square. "Of course, I could have hit them in the arm or anywhere, but I didn't shoot to kill," unquote. Sergei says he had been a regular protester on the Maidan for more than a month, and that his shots at police on the square and on the roof of an underground shopping mall caused them to retreat. There had been shooting 2 days earlier, on February 18th. The 19th, a Wednesday, had been quieter, but in the evening, Sergei says, he was put in contact with a man who offered him two guns, one a 12-gauge shotgun, the other a hunting rifle, a Saiga, S-A-I-G-A, that fired high-velocity rounds. He chose the latter, he says, and stashed it in the post office building a few yards from the conservatory. Both buildings were under the control of the protesters. When the shooting started early on the morning of the 20th, Sergei says, he was escorted to the conservatory and spent some 20 minutes before 7 o'clock firing on police alongside a second gunman. His account is partially corroborated by other witnesses. That morning, Andrei Shevchenko, S-H-E-V-C-H-E-N-K-O, then an opposition member of parliament and part of the Maidan movement, had received a phone call from the head of the riot police on the square. He calls me and says, quote, "Andrei, somebody is shooting at my guys," unquote. And he said that the shooting was from the conservatory, unquote. Shevchenko contacted the man in charge of security for the protesters, Andrei Parabui, known as the commandant of the Maidan, parenthetically, again, a member of Svoboda, and also the interim defense minister, with a guy from the even farther right, successor to the OUNB, Pravi Sektor, Dmitry Yarosh, as the deputy defense minister in the provisional government. Again, with this last sentence, Shevchenko contacted the man in charge of security for the protesters, Andrei Parabui from Svoboda, known as the commandant of the Maidan. Quote, "I sent a group of my best men to go through the entire conservatory building and determine whether there were any firing positions," unquote, Parabui says. Meanwhile, the MP, Andrei Shevchenko, was getting increasingly panicked phone calls. "I kept getting calls from the police officer who said, I have three people wounded, I have five wounded, I have one person dead." And at some point, he says, "I'm pulling out," and he says, "Andrei, I do not know what will be next, but I clearly felt that something really bad was about to happen." Andrei Parabui, again from Svoboda and the interim defense minister, notice what he is now, now deputy speaker of the Ukrainian parliament, says his men found no gunmen in the conservatory building. But a photographer who gained access to the conservatory later in the morning, shortly after 8 a.m., took pictures there of men with guns, although he did not see them fire. Sergei's account also differs from Parabui's. "I was just reloading," he told me. "They ran up to me and one put his foot on top of me and they said, they want a word with you. Everything is okay, but stop what you're doing," unquote. Sergei says he is convinced that the men who dragged him away were Parabui's security unit, although he didn't recognize their faces. He was escorted out of the conservatory building, taken out of Kiev by car, and left to make his own way home. By that time, three policemen had been fatally wounded, and the mass killings of protesters had begun. Kiev's official investigation has focused on what happened afterwards, after the riot police began to retreat from the square. In video footage, they are clearly seen firing towards protesters as they pull back. Only three people have been arrested, all of them members of a special unit of riot police. And of these three, only two, the lower-ranking officers, remain in custody. The unit's commanding officer, Dmitry Sadovnik, S-A-D-O-V-N-I-K, was granted bail and has now disappeared. Some of the dead were almost certainly shot by snipers who seemed to be shooting from some of the taller buildings surrounding the square. Lawyers for the victims and sources in the general prosecutor's office have told the BBC that when it comes to investigating deaths that could not have been caused by the riot police, they have found their efforts blocked by the courts. If you think of Yanukovych's time, it was like a Bermuda Triangle, the prosecutor's office, the police, and the courts, says Andrei Shevchenko. Everyone knew that they cooperated, they covered each other, and that was the basis of the massive corruption in the country. Those connections still exist. Ukraine's Prosecutor General Vitaly Yarema, Y-A-R-E-M-A, was dismissed this week amid harsh criticism of his handling of the investigation. The leaders of the Maidan have always maintained that they did their best to keep guns away from the square. We knew that our strength was not to use force, and our weakness would be if we started shooting, says Andrei Shevchenko. Parabri says it is possible that a handful of protesters with weapons may have come to Maidan as part of a spontaneous, unorganized response to violence from the security forces in the days running up to February 20th. I did hear that after the shootings on 18th of February, there were guys who came to Maidan with hunting rifles. I was told that sometimes they were the relatives of parents of those people who were killed on the 18th. So I concede that it's possible there were people with hunting rifles on Maidan. When the snipers began to kill our guys, one after another, I can imagine that those with the hunting rifles returned fire, unquote. Sergei, again, tells a different story. He says he was recruited by as a potential shooter in late January by a man he describes only as a retired military officer. Sergei himself was a former soldier. And again, concerning the shooting of the security forces in the Maidan Square. There certainly were protesters who were shooting. Recall in an earlier broadcast, we took a look at a fellow named Michael Skilt, S-K-I-L-L-I-T. He was a Swedish former soldier and a sniper, and he discusses being in the Maidan and of performing sniper services. One wonders how he got there and who recruited him. The point being that there certainly were shooters on the side of the protesters, and that the area from which they were seen to be shooting was under the control of Andrei Parabri of Svoboda, later the interim defense minister, now the deputy speaker of the Ukrainian parliament. More about the Maidan massacre. This, reviewing some information that we looked at earlier, this from the Reuters.com website of October 10th of 2014. This is a story by Steve Stecklow, S-T-E-C-K-L-O-W, and Oleksandr Akimenko, O-L-E-K-S-A-N-D-R, A-K-Y-M-E-N-K-O. Special report, flaws found in Ukraine's probe of Maidan massacre. And this reads in part, for millions of Ukrainians, it was a crime against humanity. In February, more than 100 protesters were gunned down in the Maidan uprising that toppled the president, Viktor Yanukovych. The victims are now known as the Heavenly Hundred, unquote. In April, prosecutors arrested three suspects, members of an elite unit within the Berkut riot police. Senior among them was Dmytro Sadovnik, S-A-D-O-V-N-Y-K, 38, a decorated commander who was accused of ordering his men to fire on the crowds on the morning of February 20th. The three stand accused of murdering 39 unarmed prosecutors. On September 19th, the case took a turn when a judge released Sadovnik into house arrest, and 2 weeks later, he went missing. Maidan activists were outraged and convinced that a corrupt system had let a killer escape. The judge was placed under investigation. The prosecutor said in a statement, D. Sadovnik, suspected of committing an extremely grievous crime, aiming to avoid punishment, disappeared from the place of permanent, from his place of permanent residence, unquote. But in a country where justice often isn't blind, there's another possibility. Sadovnik was being framed and saw flight as his best option. In court last month, he called the case against him a political lynching, unquote. In the days before he vanished, his wife and his lawyer say Sadovnik and his family received death threats. A Reuters examination of Ukraine's probe into the Maidan shootings, based on interviews with prosecutors, defense attorneys, protesters, police officers, and legal experts, has uncovered serious flaws in the case against Sadovnik and two other Berkut officers. Among the evidence presented against Sadovnik was a photograph. Prosecutors say it shows him near Kiev's Independence Square on February 20th, wearing a mask and holding a rifle with two hands, his fingers clearly visible. The problem, Sadovnik doesn't have two hands. His right hand, his wife told Reuters, was blown off by a grenade in a training accident 6 years ago. As prosecutors introduced the image at the hearing in April, and Yulia Sadovnik, her husband removed the glove and displayed his stump to the courtroom. That last sentence again. As prosecutors introduced the image at the hearing in April, said Yulia Sadovnik, her husband removed a glove and displayed his stump to the courtroom. He can't really shoot, says Sergei Vilkov, Sadovnik's lawyer. To blame him for the crime is a political game, unquote. And again, in the rest of the story, we have noted that the fellow in charge of this, quote, investigation, unquote, again was Oleg Makhnitsky. He was the acting prosecutor general or attorney general in the Ukraine, and he is now an advisor to President Poroshenko. He also, like Andrei Parubiy, who was in charge of the areas from which demonstrators were seen to have been shooting, is a member of the Svoboda Party. The GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter of February 23rd of 2015 also took up the issue of a possible provocation at the Maidan and noted some of the things that we have noted in terms of there being certainly snipers among the protesters, and noting the fact that elements like Svoboda were in charge of the areas from which the shooting that appears to have aggravated the security forces took place. The article from GermanForeignPolicy.com, which feeds along the lower right-hand side of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website. This is from GermanForeignPolicy.com of February 23rd of 2015, from Rasak to Maidan. And it talks about the Maidan, and then it compares the ginning up of information about what is going on in Ukraine with the ginning up of information that was used to justify the Balkans wars and the Kosovo intervention in particular. As with Kosovo, as with the earlier Balkan wars, the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, was evolved from the 21st Waffen-SS Division or Skanderbeg Division from World War II and other fascist fighting forces. We looked at that in For the Record Program 161, among other broadcasts. And what this article talks about is something that became known as the Rasak Massacre. That's R-A-C-A-K. In fact, this was not a massacre, but rather propaganda that was used to create the narrative of a Serbian genocidal onslaught against the residents of Kosovo, and this in turn justified the NATO intervention on behalf of Kosovo. I would note that the UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, headed up by Karl von Habsburg, regards Kosovo as its first major success story. I would also note that Karl von Habsburg is very active now in Ukraine and heads up a radio station in the, quote, new, unquote, Ukraine. His father, Otto von Habsburg, the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire's throne, got together with Yaroslav Stetsko, the wartime president of Ukraine, who collaborated with and implemented the massacre policies of the Third Reich. He put together an organization with Yaroslav Stetsko put together an organization with Otto von Habsburg basically seeking to free Ukraine from the Soviet Union and also ultimately to sort of have it as a neo-fascist state and perhaps ultimately in the views of the Habsburgs, part of a neo-Austro-Hungarian empire. And in any event, noting the common Habsburg presence in both Ukraine and in Kosovo and elsewhere in the former Yugoslavia, and noting the similarity between the ginning up of information in Ukraine and the ginning up of information in the Balkans, again used to justify the injection of neo-fascist elements evolved from World War II collaborators and combatants. That is a comparison to be borne in mind. Again, from GermanForeignPolicy.com from February 23rd of 2015, skipping down. In spite of all the unsolved mysteries surrounding it, the Rasak massacre is still today used to justify, Yanukovych's overthrow and brings to mind similar methods used in earlier conflicts, for example, to justify the military aggression against Yugoslavia. At the time, the Rasak massacre, that's R-A-C-A-K, was given the most attention. On January 16, 1999, more than 40 Kosovo-Albanian bodies were discovered in that South Serbian village. At the time, the claims by Western politicians and the media that Serbian forces of oppression had executed them have never been followed up with tangible evidence. Numerous indications point to the possibility that they had been killed in combat between Yugoslav government units and the Kosovo Liberation Army terrorist militia. The Finnish forensic specialist, Helena Ranta, R-A-N-T-A, later complained that she had been put under pressure and was given, quote, instructions, unquote, by Germany's special emissary for Kosovo, Christian Pauls, P-A-U-L-S. It had been clear, quote, that the whole group of governments had an interest in the version of what had happened in Rasak, unquote, which, again, quoting, placed responsibility on the Serbian side, unquote. Like the deadly sniper fire at the Maidan on February 20th of 2014, the causes of these deaths have never been solved. Other incidents prior to and during the war on Yugoslavia also demonstrate how long before the Ukraine conflict, news reporting in the, quote, free West, unquote, was being massively manipulated. For example, one can see this from the account furnished by German military experts who, on behalf of the OSCE and an EU mission, had observed the situation in the South Serbian province at the turn of the year 1988 to 1999. Brigadier General Heinz Loqai, L-O-Q-U-A-I, who was stationed at the German OSCE representation in Vienna in early 1999. In his conversation with GermanForeignPolicy.com, he recalls that on March 18th and 19th, he had read in an OSCE report on Kosovo, quote, the situation throughout the province remains tense but quiet, unquote. Even experts at the Ministry of Defense had drawn the conclusion on March 23rd, quote, still no trends toward ethnic cleansing are discernible, unquote. This was the situation, says Lo Kuai, that Rudolf Scharping, defense minister at the time, and his colleague Foreign Minister Fischer had, quote, compared to the Holocaust with its murder of 6 million Jews, to justify the aggression on March 24th of 1999. Dietmar Hartwig, H-A-R-T-W-I-G, a former Bundeswehr officer who had been stationed in Kosovo as an observer for the EU in 1999 up until the war, made similar observations. Hartwig explains he had no knowledge of large-scale or even state-ordered crimes against the population, unquote. Neither from the reports of his fellow observers, nor from his conversations with leading Kosovo-Albanian politicians, unquote. Yet the media was constantly claiming that the Serbian security forces were using senseless brutality on the population, unquote. Hartwig notes that, again quoting, media information that I encountered during and since the time I was in Kosovo gave a picture that had nothing to do with the reality on the ground at the time, unquote. This is also the case of the alleged Operation Horseshoe, unquote, cobbled together from dubious intelligence service files and panhandled by the German defense minister, Rudolf Scharping of the SPD, and the German government as a whole, as a Yugoslav government plan. More about Operation Horseshoe. I suspect this could be given a different name, but I couldn't use that on the air. So we'll just leave it with its official name of Operation Horseshoe. At the time, Peter Strzok told the Bundestag on April 15, 1999, the paper supposedly depicted the plan, quote, to depopulate Kosovo of ethnic Albanians, unquote. This allegation was then trumpeted without hesitation by all the leading media organs in Germany, seriously weakening opposition to the war. With this in mind, the current anti-Russian reporting in German media and recurring proof of media forgeries can be considered a normalcy in times of conflict escalation. Most recently, the second German public TV channel, ZDF, had to admit that its news report alleging that more than 50 Russian tanks had entered Ukraine had been illustrated with the photo of a Georgian tank from 2009. A graphic designer had, quote, inadvertently transformed 2009 Georgian tanks into dateless Russian tanks, unquote. The Heute.de program editor in charge, unquote, had been incapable of recognizing the mistake, unquote, explained ZDF. Last year, similar mistakes, unquote, had harvested massive criticism. From the experience during the war on Yugoslavia, it seems unlikely that before, at the moment of unforeseeable end of the conflict, there will be no change in the news reporting of major media organs, nor in the lack of serious investigation of who was really responsible for those conflict-justifying measures. And that, again, from GermanForeignPolicy.com, explaining some of the ginned-up propaganda with regard to the Balkans Wars and the Kosovo War in particular, and also, once again, returning to some of the phony journalistic coverage, unquote, of what is taking place in Ukraine. The New York Times continues to uncritically present people of explicitly fascist stripes, such as people from the Azov Battalion, without explaining who these people are. From Consortium News of February 11th of 2015, we have this story from Robert Perry, P-A-R-R-Y. New York Times wipes out Ukraine's brown shirts, and it reads in part, on Wednesday, the Times published a long article by Rick Lyman, L-Y-M-A-N, that presented the situation in the port city of Mariupol as if the advance by ethnic Russian rebels amounted to the arrival of barbarians at the gate while the inhabitants were being bravely defended by the forces of civilization. But then the article cites the key role in that defense played by the Azov Battalion. Though the article provides much color and detail, and quotes an Azov leader prominently, it leaves out one salient and well-known fact about the Azov Battalion, that it is composed of neo-Nazis who display the swastika, SS markings, and other Nazi symbols. But this inconvenient truth that neo-Nazis have been central to Kiev's self-defense forces, unquote, from last February's coup to the present, would presumably disrupt the desired propaganda message. So the New York Times just ignores it and refers to Azov as simply a volunteer unit. And another similar journalistic gambit was performed by the New York Times, this coming directly from the Times itself. The New York Times of February 13th of 2015, a story by Andrew E. Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R, and Michael R. Gordon, U.S. faults Russia as combat spikes in East Ukraine. And it quotes here, Oleg Ryashko, the leader of the Radical Party, which is part of the majority coalition in Ukraine's parliament, said that Mr. Poroshenko had made overly steep concessions to Mr. Putin that he described as a ticking time bomb, unquote, that would give Russia a premise for resuming hostilities in the East. What is not mentioned here is that Oleg Ryashko was one of the founders of the Azov Battalion. And again, now he's part of the majority coalition in the Ukrainian parliament. Andrei Parubiy is the deputy speaker of the Ukrainian parliament. Oleg Magnitsky is an advisor to Petro Poroshenko. And as we watch what takes place in Ukraine, bear in mind the mounting indications of provocation in the Maidan shootings and the inclination on the part of groups like Pravi Sektor and Svoboda and other OUNB heirs towards A, the suppression of truth, and B, the generation of incidents which would lead credence to the narrative that they are trying to present to people. In that regard, James Inhofe, a Republican senator from Oklahoma, was shown some photographs purporting to show Russian military invasion of Ukraine, and even he had to ultimately admit that these were phony photographs. An article from the BuzzFeed blog from February 12th of 2015. Here's the Ukrainian delegation that gave misleading photos to senators' offices by Rosie Gray, G-R-A-Y. A delegation consisting of Ukrainian members of parliament, a paramilitary leader, and one Georgetown professor gave a senator's office photos purportedly of the Russian military invading Ukraine that were later debunked. Several photos allegedly showing the Russian military in eastern Ukraine that ran on the Washington Free Beacon on Tuesday were quickly shown to actually be photos from other conflicts, some from years earlier. A spokesman for Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe told the Free Beacon that the office had procured the photos from a Ukrainian delegation, unquote, in December. Again, note that this is from members of the Ukrainian parliament. There is a link that shows just exactly who they were. One of the members, we talked about this in For the Record 826, that some of these people have been, and 832 as well, are openly lobbying for direct U.S. military involvement in the Ukrainian war. And one of these fellows was described, it was basically a fellow who is from the UPA, president of the UPA. And that's a guy named Anatoly Pinchuk, P-I-N-C-H-U-K. The UPA is presumably the Ukrainian Partisan Army. That is the military formation that was the combatant wing of the OUNB and has been honored by the current government in Ukraine. There was a tweet by Mark Ames, again, Twitter of February 13th of 2015. Senator Inhofe snookered by president of the UPA, Ukrainian wartime collaborators who participated in the Holocaust. And I would note, in that regard, as we see the mounting, quote, information, unquote, about the, quote, Russian invasion, unquote, that the very same elements that are presenting this kind of information to Senator Inhofe and to news media and are being uncritically portrayed by the New York Times and other, quote, journalistic organs, unquote, are part and parcel to Pravda Sektor and Svoboda, and part of the OUNB Ukrainian diaspora that is so active in the U.S. and had penetrated intelligence services and the Republican Party, as we have seen in past programs. It would appear that there are some Pravda Sektor cells in the U.S. From the Political Research Associates website of October 8th of last year, 2014, an article by someone who posts under the name of Spencer Sunshine, attack on New York City art gallery highlights fascist organizing in U.S. immigrant communities, and it reads in part as follows. Last week, the New York City stop of the Material Evidence photo exhibition spotlighting the conflicts in Ukraine and Syria was attacked. The curator was maced, the exhibit was vandalized, and fascist propaganda was left behind. As unlikely as an attack on a well-heeled art gallery may seem, it's only the latest in a number of similar events in the city which are tied to expatriate fascist organizing. Although the identities of the alleged assailants are unknown, the New York Material Evidence show has been the focus of some ire from some Ukrainian nationalists since its opening, because they claim it is a pro-Russian propaganda vehicle. The flyers left behind, among other things, apparently promoted the Azov Battalion, an anti-separatist Ukraine volunteer group with links to the ultra-nationalist Right Sector Party and considered by some to be fascist. The battalion is also the favorite place for foreign far-right volunteers. In Chicago this past spring, a group of 40 Ukrainian nationalists attempted to disrupt an anti-fascist meeting about the Ukraine situation. They left behind Right Sector literature. In 2014, Right Sector had chapter meetings in New York and New Jersey. They have participated in at least two public demonstrations at the Russian consulate in New York, and have been active in fundraising for non-military supplies for the Ukrainian military. And one of the few people who has been willing to sort of resist the drift for war is George Eliason, or Eliason, E-L-I-A-S-O-N. And in the op-ed news of January 29th of this year, 2015, he noted a couple of slip-ups in the Ukrainian media. He, by the way, is a web designer who lives and works in Ukraine. And even the carefully controlled Ukrainian media have occasionally slipped up and inadvertently admitted that there is no Russian invasion. Again, Kiev announces Russian invasion of Ukraine a hoax, by George Eliason, from the op-ed news of January 29th of 2015. Throughout this conflict, every once in a while, Ukrainian government officials have come clean about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. To the chagrin of the Obama administration and NATO, Russia has not invaded. This latest admission came twice today, once by inference and the other a direct admission from Ukrainian Armed Forces Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Viktor Muzhenko. During a brief meeting, General Muzhenko announced that, quote, to date, we have only the involvement of some members of the armed forces of the Russian Federation and Russian citizens that are part of illegal armed groups involved in the fighting. We are not fighting with the regular Russian army. We have enough forces and means in order to inflict a final defeat, even with the illegal armed formations present, he said. If that wasn't embarrassing enough for the Poroshenko regime, which has consistently stated that Russia has invaded and that Ukraine is fighting the Russian army, it was Petro Poroshenko's own TV station, Channel 5 News, that broke the story. Earlier in the day, Ukrainian military spokesman Lysenko said he was worried that if a provocation were staged, Russia would justify bringing in the Russian army. Obviously, if they're already there, then that could not take place. Again, and for the record, program number 811, we noted that the, quote, reconnaissance photographs, unquote, purporting to show Russian invasions of Ukraine and Russian military equipment in Ukraine come not from U.S. spy satellites, but from a private company called Digital Globe that was founded by veterans of Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, as it was popularly known, and its executives have backgrounds with Bain & Company, Mitt Romney's old firm, and with IHS, Information Handling Services, the Thyssen-Bornemisza subsidiary company that is the epicenter of the peak oil propaganda as well. We're going to be looking at that in For the Record program number 811, among others. And the reliance on Digital Globe, again, this is another tweet, February 13th of 2015, Jeffrey Pyatt, P-Y-A-T-T, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Debalt Seve, or the Cauldron, as it has been known. We are confident these are Russian military, not separatist systems, unquote. And the pictures and the link is included in the description for the program. The pictures are from Digital Globe. And as we sift through information and disinformation, remember that the head of the special study mission from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe is a guy named Michael Bashurku, who is the former assistant editor for the Ukrainian Weekly. That's a publication that is very, very close to the OUNB and that basically reflects the perspectives of the OUNB. Michael Bashurku is also heavily networked with a Malaysian Muslim Brotherhood network that figures in the investigations into the disappearance of Malaysian Air Flight MH370, as well as the plane MH17 that went down in Ukraine. So again, remember, as we hear about the alleged Russian invasions, etc., that the head of the OSCE's observer mission is anything but an impartial observer. A story talking about that. BBC News of February 14th of 2015. Ukraine crisis. Poroshenko says peace deal in danger. And it quotes Michael Bashurku, spokesman for the OSCE. It doesn't mention that he was the assistant editor of the Ukrainian Weekly or his links to the Malaysian Muslim Brotherhood milieu that looms large in the disappearance and downing of two recent Malaysian planes, one of them MH Flight 17 in Ukraine. One of the things that I have wondered about, and that concerns the military situation in Ukraine, and I've wondered about the fact that the Ukrainian army really hasn't done very well, and I wondered to what extent the fact that they are basically shooting at and killing their fellow citizens has something to do with low morale. That would appear to be at least partially true. An article from Newsweek of February 6th of 2015. Ukraine passes law to shoot deserters. This is by Damian Sharkov. And again, it talks about the fact that the Ukrainian parliament has just passed a measure permitting Ukrainian military officers to shoot deserters. And I suspect that low morale and the inclination to desertion is linked to the poor performance of the Ukrainian military on the battlefield. That, in turn, I suspect, has much to do with the fact that they are shooting at and killing their fellow citizens. This is, after all, a civil war. One of the few people, again, to note the genuine grievances of people in eastern Ukraine is Robert Perry of Consortium News. On February 9th of 2015, he had a story, Wretched U.S. Journalism in Ukraine. And he talks about not only the genuine ethnic complaints of the eastern Ukraine, the overt discrimination against Ukrainians of Russian ethnic affiliation is a matter of public record. He also notes the fact that some $160 billion would have been lost had the Ukraine allied itself with EU as opposed to Russia. Many of the people in eastern Ukraine are dependent on trade with Russia for their livelihoods. The same story also notes that the anxiety on the part of people in eastern Ukraine over the harsh EU austerity measures, which are something that many of the people in Ukraine were reluctant to embrace, particularly those in the eastern Ukraine, who are also going to be punished by having a lot of the income they derived from trade with Russia being negated by the potential alliance with the EU, which was at the core of the Maidan controversy. And again, that article was excerpted in the description for the record, 837. For the record, programs 824, 826, and 832, we have noted the return to Ukraine of some of the Ukrainian diaspora. And just a bizarre appointment, a woman named Janika Mirilo, that first name J-A-A-N-I-K-A, last name M-E-R-I-L-O, has been appointed the minister, she's been appointed an assistant to Natalie Jaresko, the Ukrainian-American former State Department officer who managed a company that was capitalized by the Agency for International Development. And Ms. Mirilo, well, again, if she were Miley Cyrus, the sorts of photographs she has been posting of herself on the internet would be more or less standard operating procedure. But for a woman who not only is a member of the Estonian parliament, but who now is going to be an assistant to the finance minister of Ukraine and is a businesswoman, this is altogether inappropriate. The article and accompanying photographs from the Naked Capitalism blogspot, no pun intended here, January 20th of 2015, an article, John Helmer, The Lure of Foreign Investment in Ukraine, Meet Janika Mirilo, is posted by Eve Smith. And another very interesting appointment indeed. Again, this article is, and a link to the article and an excerpt are in the description for the record 837. In addition to Ms. Mirilo, the former president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, was appointed as an advisor to Poroshenko. And again, among the many websites reporting on this, the Focus Information Agency of February 14th of 2015, ex-Georgian president says will coordinate Ukraine arms supply issue. Former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili was appointed Friday as the chairman of Ukraine's International Consultative Reform Council and has said he will coordinate the issue of arms supplies to Kiev. And another article from the Democracy and Freedom Watch of February 14th of 2005, Saakashvili appointed advisor to Ukraine's Poroshenko, notes the following. Skipping down, prosecutors in Georgia have charged Saakashvili in four different criminal cases, which include covering up the murder of a 28-year-old bank employee in 2006. Toward the end of his nearly 10-year term, the last in a fragile power-sharing agreement with a hostile coalition, his rule became increasingly unpopular. Toward the end, the coalition called Georgian Dream won a landslide victory in 2012 on the promise to restore justice. Skipping down. Last year, Saakashvili was personally charged. He is currently wanted for covering up the murder of bank employee Sandro Givigliani in 2006, for ordering the leaking of the beating of a parliamentarian in 2005, embezzlement of more than $4 million, and for ordering the violent dispersal of an opposition rally and the storming of a TV studio in 2008. Well, he'll certainly make a very good advisor to Petro Poroshenko with all of those Maidan veterans in his cabinet. And although we haven't got time to read it, another excerpt from Consortium News, February 23rd of 2015, Ready for Nuclear War Over Ukraine, it's by Robert Perry, and it notes that a senior Ukrainian official is urging the West to go to war over Ukraine and risk the possibility of a nuclear war. And with people like Mikhail Saakashvili working as an advisor to Poroshenko, that things could escalate in that regard is not a possibility to be too readily dismissed. Again, the description for the show has all of these articles in the description with links. This concludes For the Record program number 837, Cauldron, Update on Ukraine. This has been recorded on March 1st of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.